Welcome to episode 16 of the Red Seat Podcast. I'm your host, Jake Devereaux, and today I'm joined by Ben Carsley, editor of BP Boston, and Xander Bogaerts enthusiast. Ben, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, and I think that is my new preferred title wherever I go. I'd like to be known as a Xander Bogaerts enthusiast and be introduced as such in all formal settings from now on.
Yeah, you know, I thought of you quite a bit yesterday during the Red Sox Sunday night baseball game against the Yankees when they kept showing graphics of Xander's family and then breaking into small montages of Xander Bogaerts, and they showed, like, really cute pictures of his face and all that stuff, and I was like, Ben's probably really enjoying this right now.
Yeah, the weird thing is that if you look really closely, I'm in the background of most of those pictures.
Let's hope not. So, for everybody out there, if you're interested in following Ben, who stalks Xander, you can follow him on Twitter at Ben Carsley, just his name there. So, nothing too crazy there. What was crazy, though, and we haven't had a chance to talk about it on the podcast, is the trade that the Red Sox made for Drew Pomeranz. When it happened, I was out in the middle of nowhere at a random brewery in the middle of the state, so I didn't have a great internet connection, and I was like fumbling with my phone, but you know, I was able to weigh in on it a little bit, not nearly as much as you have with the articles that you've written, and they've been very good, so I urge everybody to check those out. And you know, it's been written about a ton so far, but not discussed here, so we'll spend a significant amount of time on that tonight. First of all, I just wanted to get your rough thoughts about the trade and, you know, if you thought it was the right move, because I think there were a lot of people on both sides of the coin. I know my first initial reaction was, oh my God, we just gave up Anderson Espinosa. The sky is falling. And I've come off that a little bit, but I wanted to get what your initial take was and kind of what your more nuanced take on it is now.
Yeah, and honestly, Jake, that's a very fair reaction to have up front. I mean, I remember I was on GChat when I saw that, you know, the only news we had was Drew Pomeranz has traded to the Red Sox. And I was GChatting with Brett Sayer and Craig Goldstein, who are two members of the prospect team at BP. Well, Brett's the managing editor now that he's fancy, but prospect-focused guys who I hold in high esteem. And, you know, we were sort of talking in the half an hour before the details came out about who it could be, and there was a lot of Michael Kopech thrown around. Personally, I sort of thought it would be Devers. Devers made the most sense to me. And then it came out that it was Espinosa, who, you know, to me is in the same tier as Devers. You know, we talk about the Red Sox Big Four prospects, but within those Big Four, I think Moncada and Benintendi are one tier, and that Devers and Espinosa are the others.
Yeah, I agree with you there for sure.
Yeah, and I agree that we definitely paid $100 cents on the dollar for Pomeranz. I don't think there is any way getting around that. You know, this is not a guy with a very long track record of success. He's been very impressive this year. He was pretty good in Oakland last year. He had a period of success in 2014 when he was a Rocky, which is pretty impressive in its own right. But, you know, this is not a sure thing, and I think when you think about dealing a prospect like Espinosa, you think you're going to get a Sonny Gray or a Jose Fernandez or a Chris Sale, a guy like that back. The reason I've come around on this trade is because those guys aren't available. You know, the Marlins are in the thick of things. They have no reason to trade Jose Fernandez. Chris Sale is probably one of the best three or four starters in baseball. Even if the White Sox are rebuilding, they don't really have a reason to trade him, you know? I forget who else
or Quintana. They don't even really have a reason to trade Quintana with his control.
Exactly. He's so affordable. You know, Sonny Gray is having a weird year, and the Athletics have no reason to sell low on him. So there isn't that pitcher that everybody else wants available. Steven Strasburg signed the big extension. You know, he was supposed to be the big name on the free agent market this season, but A, the Nationals are too good to have traded him, and B, they signed him to an extension anyway. So there isn't this sort of affordable young ace on the market. He just does not exist. So for me, Pomeranz represented an acceptable middle ground between these sort of uber superstar aces who were going to acquire two or three of Boston's Big Four, or guys like Rich Hill, who are either good but really injury-prone, or, you know, Jeremy Hellickson and some other guys like that who wouldn't cost a lot to acquire, but who are going to be very marginal upgrades. So it was certainly a steep cost to pay for Pomeranz, but at the same time, I think Pomeranz was the only guy, you know, sort of in his sphere on the market.
Yeah, I agree with all those points. I think you hit a few really salient points there that I, you know, I felt the same way about a lot of those things. My initial reaction when I was really upset about it was, I think, mostly because I had so much more information on Anderson Espinosa, as funny as that sounds, than I did on the current version of Drew Pomeranz. You know, he's an AL West guy. And all I could think about was the fact that Espinosa is now 18 years old and dominating players in high A at times. I mean, he's struggled there a little bit, but the stuff is just incredible. And he's been doing that at an age when most kids would be going against high school competition.
They'd be in the draft.
Right.
They would just be entering professional ball.
Exactly. So we had that on one side of the coin. And then the other side of it was, since Pomeranz has been drafted all the way back in 2010 when he was a fifth overall pick, he had so many years when he was just struggling to figure it out. And I think that's probably when my prospect knowledge of other systems was at its peak during a lot of his struggles. So what I remembered from Pomeranz wasn't the guy that he currently is now. It was the guy that was struggling a little bit. And I thought back to it, and all I could think about was, this is a guy who I've seen really struggle before. You know, what's to say that he doesn't fall apart and struggle once he gets to the Red Sox? But I didn't really have the opportunity to look at all of the meaningful change that we've seen from Pomeranz since then. And I think you've done a really good job of illustrating some of that change in the articles that you've written. But a few of the things that really stuck out to me when I started doing some research on him were the batting average against, which currently sits at 182, which is the second best amongst qualified starters in the majors, 2 points ahead of Clayton Kershaw in that category. Some of the other guys that are directly behind him in that category, aside from Kershaw, are Max Scherzer, Steven Strasburg, Jake Arrieta, Madison Bumgarner, and Julio Teheran. That group is no joke. You know, that it's very, very difficult to do that, and I think that proves that on some level there has been some real change with him.
Yeah, so I think you brought up two really, really good points. The first of which, Espinosa is a much, much sexier and more fun guy to root for than Drew Pomeranz, right? When you think of Anderson Espinosa, you think of someone who could potentially headline a legit first division MLB starting rotation someday. Are the odds of him getting there, frankly, minuscule? Absolutely. You know, he's in the low minors. He's a small pitcher. You know, guys like that, 95% of the time don't work out. But dear God, if he does work out, you know, he could be the next Jose Fernandez. He could be the next guy that we're all clamoring to trade for. Pomeranz does not have that upside. He is a more mundane option to acquire, right? He's probably a middle-of-the-rotation guy in the AL East. He has a little more upside than that. He also could fall back and be more of a number four starter in the AL East. So you traded away a lot of the sex appeal when you acquired Pomeranz, and I understand why you're not initially a really favorable reaction to that type.
Yeah, the other thing that I thought about when assessing the trade was trying to put myself in Dave Dombrowski's shoes. And I think one of the things that Dave Dombrowski does really well is that he brings a lot of old-school baseball scouting knowledge to the table while doing a pretty good job, at least so far, of not ignoring too much of the sabermetric stuff at the same time. And when I thought of Anderson Espinosa and his talent evaluation on a guy like that, all I could think of is Dave Dombrowski saying to himself, there's no way that this 5'11", 160-pound guy, who already reportedly had a stress reaction in his elbow at some point over the last year or so, you know, would be able to to keep this up over the long haul, especially as a starter. I think that Dave has a pretty particular type of guy that he wants. I would bet, and I don't know this for sure, but I would bet that Dave prefers taller, more durable framed pitchers. We already know that he prefers strong defense up the middle, you know, in traditional defensive positions like center field and catcher. So I think that the evaluation was probably made by Dave that it was more likely than not that Espinosa was not going to work out like that over the long run. And a lot of people on Twitter who are pretty, you know, close to what Dave Dombrowski has done over the course of his career have been quick to point out that Dave Dombrowski has not been burned on guys very many times in his career.
I mean, it's pretty much Randy Johnson, right? Randy Johnson's the only upper echelon prospect Dombrowski has dealt away who he's really, really regretted.
Right.
And that sounds like a big if, but he's traded away a lot of guys who were top 25 prospects in their day who didn't really amount to much. Or, you know, and this is the point I want to bring up with Espinosa. Even if this isn't Dombrowski super hard betting against Espinosa, I think the single part of this entire trade that is underemphasized or underreported is the fact that Pomeranz is under control through 2018. And if you could pinpoint one thing in the Red Sox organization, not just the current MLB team, but the entire organization, the one thing they lack and the one thing they have proven unable to develop is quality starting pitching. So maybe maybe Dombrowski, like you said, thinks Espinosa just isn't all that. Maybe Dombrowski thinks Espinosa could be all that, but he just realizes that, you know what, I have the core of a team that can win in 2016, it can win in 2017, it can win in 2018, and 2018 is probably the very, very earliest you're going to see Espinosa in the majors, and he decided to take present value over future value, or really over the idea of future value. And that's a tough sell in a market like Boston. And, you know, I was on Effectively Wild a few days ago, and Sam Miller and I were talking about this. You know, we've been groomed off of Epstein and Charrington, and you hug your prospects close, and you tuck them in at night. And it's easy to mock that, but, you know, that approach is on one hand, what led to Bogarts and Betts and Bradley and all the guys you see right now. On the other hand, you know, they could have sold Cecchini and Middlebrooks and Michael Bowden and Matt Barnes and all these other guys. And it's really, really reductive, and I wish there was a smarter way to put it. But Alex Speer wrote a column, I think, this offseason that's always stuck with me. And he was just like, you know, the trick isn't holding your prospects or selling your prospects. The trick is knowing which prospects to sell. And right. It's a very obvious and sort of, you know, self-fulfilling statement, but it's exactly right. The entire trick to sort of managing these assets is knowing who to hold on to and who to ship away at the peak of his value. So it stinks to lose Espinosa, and I had a heavy heart when I first saw it, but I think it's a perfectly respectable gamble on Dombrowski's part.
Yeah, I think you make a couple really good points. First of which is Dombrowski is probably the best in the business at making that evaluation, and he does it with you know, some cold objectivity that, you know, some of us guys who did grow up in that Charrington Theo era are, you know, it sort of shakes us at our core when we see it happen, but it's probably the correct move. And then the other thing is that those years that you mentioned with Pomeranz, those are years that the young core of the Red Sox, Bradley, Betts, and Bogarts, are going to be cost controlled too before any of them start to hit the market. So you're going to have the ability to spend a lot of money without spending a lot of money on the guys that are the core of your team too. So I think that's a huge point. And also the thing that kicks in here too is that with Brian Bannister now in charge of the development of the pitching, this really gives them another 2 years to try and figure out guys like Jason Grom, who just did recently sign, and we'll talk about that later, try to develop that next wave of guys and hopefully do so successfully, and it buys them a little bit of time in that regard too. So I wanted to get into a few of the changes that Pomeranz actually made that were interesting to me. I brought up the batting average against. I should also mention right now he's 18th in the league in strikeouts minus walk rate at 18%. Interestingly enough, that's pretty much identical to what John Lester is at this season, a guy who the Red Sox let away, let get away from them, and a lot of people have been upset about that. One of the things that I didn't like, though, when looking at his profile and some of the things that I think make him a little bit risky as he heads to the AL East, the 10% walk rate that he has. And then the other thing was he's currently averaging the sixth highest amount of pitches per plate appearance of any starter in the league at 4.12. That's while doing that in the AL West. So I'm a little bit concerned that when he makes the transition over here, that could skyrocket and that we could see some Daisuke Matsuzaka-esque at-bats.
I don't think that's an unfounded concern. You know, I think those are very valid. I think, you know, more so than the, well, you know, so one is sort of the symptom of the other, right? Like the high number of pitches per plate appearance is a symptom of the high walk rate, and that is concerning, and that needs to go down. I think what has really made me a little more positive on Pomeranz is his stats against right-handed hitters, which I was just totally floored by. I mean, he's holding righties to a 171, 250, 296 triple slash line. And when you're that good against opposite side hitting, it does allow you to miss a few more bats than, you know, the rest of us would like to see. I don't think Pomeranz is a number, is a front of the rotation guy in the AL. I think he's a number three or four. But I think that's what the Red Sox need. And I would have rather had a number two. And, you know, I sort of wrote about that. I was a pretty heavy advocate of the Red Sox trading for Julio Teheran. Frankly, I still think they should. But if they're not going to do that, they at least need this, you know, sort of additional middle of the rotation stabilizer. Not totally unlike a Rick Porcello. I think Pomeranz is a higher ceiling than Rick Porcello. But, you know, even if they just added another Rick Porcello to this rotation, that's going to go a long way, because the Red Sox have started Sean O'Sullivan and Roenis Elias and this version of Clay Buchholz and Joe Kelly. I mean, they're not starting quality major league pitchers or even, you know, decent guys with a little bit of upside. They are starting bottom of the barrel trash. And a guy like Pomeranz, even if he's closer to slightly above league average than all-star, it's acceptable. It's not what you want for Anderson Espinosa, but it's acceptable.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think right now that's probably what he profiles as, is more of a three or a four starter in the AL East, which is really a helpful thing at this point. But I did read an article that I thought was really interesting from John Tomasi, where he was actually interviewing Brian Bannister about this acquisition. And he mentioned a few things that I thought were pretty interesting, one of which is that tall lefties do tend to peak pretty late. And a few of the things that people have pointed out about Pomeranz as being unsustainable, his 240 batting average on balls in play and his 80% strand rate, Bannister does attribute to the cutter that he does throw. He says that cutter guys typically are able to beat those numbers. And then he also talks about one of his best pitches, the power curveball. And the cutter and the curveball are pitches that he is throwing more this year than he has in the past, in two pitches that he's getting extremely high whiff rates on this season. That curveball is a really interesting pitch, though. It comes in at about 80 miles an hour from the left-hand side, and, you know, with a lot of downward plane because he is 6'6". It does seem like this guy, like Bannister says, could have some more in the tank and is really just starting to figure out how to pitch with this new pitch mix that he has.
Yeah, and Evan Drellich posted a great interview with Pomeranz very, very shortly after the trade. And Pomeranz, you know, he's asking Pomeranz, what has made you successful, whereas, you know, you were not as successful earlier in his career. And he said that, number one, he didn't have the feel for his curveball in Colorado, and he didn't really attribute that to anything, but, you know, given what we know about Coors Field, it's not shocking to hear that, right?
Right.
And second of all, he said the cutter. He said he found the cutter this year, a little bit late last year, and that really, you know, that third pitch, you could probably argue it's the second best pitch behind the curveball.
Right.
That third pitch has really allowed him to dominate in a way that he was not able to before. And, you know, it's a small sample size. I'm not coming out here and saying that he's the next John Lester, but to me, it lends more reason to optimism than a guy who has just been doing the same thing that's getting better numbers now. You know, this is a man who has actively changed his approach, has changed his repertoire, and we're seeing the benefits of that. So that's where I gain my sense of optimism that he can, at the very least, be a mid-rotation arm.
Yep, and he is now throwing the same pitch mix as Clayton Kershaw, for what it's worth. He is also a tall lefty, and they both have similarly awesome curveballs, which is not hyperbole there. They actually are very comparable curveballs at this point. So
when you take into consideration the contracts, I think it's fair to say you'd rather have Drew Pomeranz.
Yeah, exactly. It's
you heard it here first.
But, you know, what all this really amounts to, though, is that after being initially really disheartened by this, doing all of the research, and I have spared no detail, I really do feel a lot more comfortable with this trade and the gamble. So, you know, for everybody out there that follows me on Twitter, I have come around, and I hope you will, too. And I do hope it works out, because there's still certainly some real potential for it not to, but I think it's more likely than not that it will.
And I think being against the trade is totally reasonable. I want people to accept that it's at least a reasonable risk. Even if it's not a risk you would have taken, this is not a crazy move by Dombrowski.
I like it. So one of the things I wanted to talk about was the article that you released yesterday on Julio Teheran and the fact that the Red Sox should still be going after him. I thought that was a really interesting article, and one of the reasons, I'm not sure if you did mention it in your article, but one of the reasons why I've been an advocate for them still going after Rich Hill has been this this innings cap for Drew Pomeranz, and I know that they've talked about him not having any cap there, but he's already reached his career high of 102 for this season. You know, Dombrowski thinks he can continue to go farther, as does Bannister. But I wonder if acquiring a second guy might allow them to not only, for all the reasons that you've said, that they should trade for Teheran, which we'll talk about in a second, but also to cover them against that innings cap, too. I think that that's a point we should probably touch on before we do dive into Teheran. Do you think that's valid?
I think, so there are a bunch of factors in play when you start talking about Teheran versus Hill. And obviously, you know, I know you're not the biggest Teheran guy in the world, but, you know, I'm assuming on neutral ground you would prefer Teheran?
For sure. I'm more interested in, like, whether or not you are concerned about that innings limit first.
So this is going to, it's going to be a roundabout way to answer this. I think the Red Sox just need more quality starting pitching, and that's the one thing they can't develop, right? They can develop pretty much everything else,
right?
And they've proven an ability to do that. I think Teheran represents the one thing they cannot grow internally, which is a young, good, reliable starting pitcher. So when I suggested they still trade for Teheran, it really wasn't as much a hedge against Pomeranz as it was, you know, this would be another good young pitcher who's not just for this year, but who's for the next, you know, several seasons in which I see the Red Sox being a highly competitive team. In terms of Rich Hill specifically, if he's not going to cost a lot, I'm all for it. Don't get me wrong. But A, I think he is going to cost a lot. And B, we cannot expect this man to stay on the mound. Like, right. That's been his problem his entire career. You cannot have any reasonable expectation that even if you do acquire Rich Hill, he's going to give you more than 10 starts. So if we're talking about sending a Michael Chavis or a Luis Alexander Basabe or a Travis Likens for Rich Hill, okay, I can swallow that. But if we're talking about anything more than that, I can't do it for what might be only a handful of good starts.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that point. If the cost is anything more than that, we have to stay away. And I laughed when I found out, as I'm sure you probably did as well, when the Oakland Athletics were reportedly asking the same price Anderson Espinosa as the Padres got for Drew Pomeranz for Rich Hill. I just thought that was kind of crazy, but may as well shoot for the moon there if you're them. I mean, I don't hate the idea of going after Tehran. So I read your article, and the first thing I thought was, I could live with that package. And a lot of the things made sense. You pointed out that aside from John Lester, Clay Buchholz, and Justin Masterson, the Red Sox have been pretty miserable developing homegrown starting pitching over the last 10 years. And this is something that a lot of Red Sox writers have dove into over the last few weeks. And Tehran has been a lot better on the field than I think a lot of people give him credit for, myself included. And when I was doing research on Drew Pomerantz, he started to come up on a lot of those same lists. And one of the things that stood out to me was the fact that he also induced a whole lot of weak contact. So I wanted to talk about that and how you think he might play at Fenway with that ability to induce weak contact, even though he is a little bit more of a fly ball pitcher than a guy like Pomerantz.
Yeah, so as I said in the article that I posted on Sunday, I think in the AL East, Tehran's probably more of a number three, right? I don't think he's going to be uber dominant. You know, his home run and his fly ball tendencies certainly worry me a little bit, but he does miss some bats. Like you said, he does have a tendency to earn some weak contact, and he can stay on the mound. And he's only 25, so I do still also think there's a little bit of upside left in him. So I think if you're looking at him as a savior, you're barking up the wrong tree. But, you know, we talked earlier about the Pomerantz acquisition and how I thought that might be a little bit of a better version of Rick Porcello. You know, I think Tehran is even another level above that. I think he's a guy who could credibly be your number two starter. You know, maybe in an ideal AL rotation, he's your number three. But he's 25. He's under control for the next three seasons very affordably with a very, very team-friendly option for 2020. There's just not a ton of risk in acquiring him other than the pieces that you give up. And I think the package I suggested was Devers, Erod, Owens, and sort of the name of prospects that we just mentioned. Like,
yeah,
you
know, Dubon.
Right, Dubon. I'm sorry, Matt Collins. I'm not sorry because I hate you. Travis Likens, Pat Light, I think I mentioned. You know, basically my argument was that if you can acquire Tehran without giving up Moncada or Benintendi, you should look long and hard at it.
Yeah, and I thought about that package too when I read it, and I decided that I would certainly do that. I think that there's an argument to be made that the Red Sox, with the acquisition of Drew Pomerantz and with David Price, have also become a little bit lefty heavy, and I'm not sure you want to let a guy like Eduardo Rodriguez continue to develop as a power lefty in Fenway when you could potentially include him in a package to get a more finished right-hander like Julio Tehran. So when I thought about that package, I definitely was into it. It does make me have pause to think about trading any of the top two guys in Moncada or Benintendi for those guys. And you did touch on that too, saying that you're 100% sure you wouldn't trade for Moncada and 90% sure that you wouldn't trade Benintendi for him. I'm wondering if you're standing by that. I would think pretty long and hard about it if it was based around Benintendi.
I guess, you know, the reason I said that is if the Braves were willing to accept Benintendi straight up for Tehran, I think I might do that. If that's really all they wanted, you know, I think Tehran fits more of a need. I think Benintendi is going to be a very solid everyday starting outfielder in this league. I'm not sure I'm really sold on him as a star, at which point I sort of see it as trading one good player for another. If they ask for Benintendi and anything else, absolutely.
I think
so. That's the only reason. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just think if I'm going to throw a comp on Benintendi right now, my gut says that Benintendi is going to be Alex Gordon in his prime. I think that's pretty much what we've got here.
Yeah, I don't think the Gordon comp is terrible. I think of Benintendi as a little more of an average and speed guy than Gordon was. You know, Gordon did have a little bit more power than I think I see Benintendi having, at least early in his career. But in terms of like a plus to plus plus defensive profile in left field, with a pretty good bat and a great OBP, I totally I totally get you on that front. I just think that, you know, now that we have Bogarts and Betts, the tendency is to compare everybody to them, and I really only think Moncada is that type of player. I love Benintendi, and like I said, if the Braves wanted Benintendi plus a really significant piece for Teheran, I'm more than happy holding what we have and hoping Eduardo Rodriguez can turn it around. But if it was really just Teheran for Benintendi, I think I would pull the trigger on that.
Yeah, certainly worth discussion, especially considering the inability to develop those guys internally so far. So I wanted to move on here a little bit and talk about whether or not you think that the Red Sox are going to be done trading for the remainder of this two-week period before the deadline. Dave Dombrowski has been pretty upfront, typically, with when he says the Red Sox are done, and he has said that they are probably done making big moves. But there are a few guys out there that they could still look at. You know, you mentioned Teheran, Rich Hill, we already talked about a little bit. But a few other guys that I think could become available are the two relievers from the New York Yankees. They really should become sellers. I kind of always doubt that the Yankees actually will, because they never do. And then the Red Sox are also reportedly looking into some of the top relievers from the Milwaukee Brewers, Jeremy Jeffress, Will Smith, Tyler Thornburg. Dave Cameron wrote about Thornburg today. Because the pen has looked a little bit shaky lately with Taz going down and then Koji, you know, just being like 200 years old and that splitter not splitting sometimes. So I wanted to get your take on whether or not there's any real need in your mind for them to continue trading and whether or not you think that any of those guys are realistic targets. The Yankees are an interesting one because they are in division.
Right. It's a really, really good question. I guess I'll answer it first in terms of what I think they need. You know, as much as I advocate for a Teheran trade, I like Eduardo Rodriguez, and I don't think it's insane to bank on him being your fifth starter for the rest of the season, right? Like, he has upside. He was certainly at least a capable fifth starter last year. He's still young, so I think another starter is the thing they're least likely to trade for. Once you get into the bullpen, another really good late-inning arm would be great, but at the same time, you know, that's already a unit they've invested very, very heavily in. They traded for Craig Kimbrell. They traded for Carson Smith. They traded for Brad Siegler. You know, Koji Uehara he's not unaffordable by reliever standards, but he's not cheap. You know, Tozawa's in his last year before free agency. This is already a unit they've invested very heavily in. So if for some reason you can get, you know, I think Will Smith and Tyler Thornburg are probably the most realistic targets you mentioned. I especially like Will Smith because I think he's, 90% of one of the Yankees guys at maybe 70% of the cost. I've always been a Tyler Thornburg fan, and if Craig and Brett are listening to this, they'll make fun of me. But either of those two arms are great. I'm not sure I'd pay a premium for one of the Yankee arms. You know, it would be tough to trade in the division. Chapman, I have a tough time stomaching personally. Obviously, he'd be a good fit. Miller, there's been a lot about the Yankees trading Miller, but they really don't need to. He's under control for two more years, and it's not 100% the Yankees can't compete next year, you know?
Right.
They're as flawed as they are, they're still only, six games out right now? So they have some money coming off the books if they make a few decent trades or a good signing. You know, they could be at least in the thick of things again next year. So of all the names you've mentioned, I think Thornburg or Smith would make the most sense, but both of those guys are high leverage arms who are under control for the next at least three or four seasons, so they're going to probably cost you a top 10 prospect as well.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. I think the prospect would probably come off more of the back end of the top 10 if it was to be Smith or Thornburg or one of those guys, and I think I'd probably be okay with that price given the Red Sox current need and the fact that their prospect depth is still pretty exceptional right now. But I thought that the Yankees guys were really interesting because of the reason that you just said. The Yankees really don't have to sell Andrew Miller, but they probably should considering their system is good, but it isn't as elite as it could be. And this kind of brought me to a whole nother train of thought, because I also heard earlier in the week that the Rays, when asked if any of their pitchers were going to become available, they also said that they would prefer not to trade any of their pitchers in the division when asked if the Red Sox were in on any of their guys. So I'm wondering if this trading in the division thing is still as big a deal as it's made out to be. And it kind of seems like it is, and it makes sense that it is. But we did see it happen with Eduardo, and I wonder kind of how Baltimore feels about that whole thing. And it hasn't really bit them so far, but for a half season of Andrew Miller, the Red Sox are going to have Eduardo for probably the next 4 or 5 seasons.
Yeah, it's really, really tough to answer. Because I don't know how to quantify how big of a deal it's made. I do think it's a substantial barrier. I think that, if you asked the Red Sox to make a trade and told them to rank the 29 other teams in preference who they'd trade to, I think the bottom four would all be the rest of the AL East. Do I think that will absolutely prevent them from making a necessary deal? No. Just like the Erod for Andrew Miller trade you mentioned a while ago. I think it gets easier when you talk about, really, really complimentary players who are on the periphery of a roster, like when the Red Sox traded Steven Drew to the Yankees. There I don't think it's so much of an issue. But if you're going to trade a key contributor within the division, I would not be surprised if the team trading away the younger player asked for a bit of a premium because of the interdivision nature of the trade.
Yep, I think you're probably right about that. If the Red Sox are going to make a deal, though, it probably would be because Junichi Tozawa does have some more setbacks with his arm. At this point, I am beginning to be pretty worried about Tozawa's health. He has kind of had dead arm the last couple of seasons here. Tozawa is expected to come back fairly shortly right now. Kelly is also supposed to join the pen soon. He pitched 2 shutout innings to close out a game in Pawtucket just a few days ago. Reportedly looked pretty good there. So those guys are both on their way back. And that kind of brings up another question here about what the Red Sox are going to do with Clay Buchholz when those guys do come back. Because right now the bullpen is Uehara, Ziegler, Hembree, Ross, Barnes, Lane, and Buchholz. And Buchholz really is one of those guys in there, maybe along with Tommy Lane, who figures to get the least amount of work out of that bullpen. And I think those other two guys probably help you a little bit more. So has Clay Buchholz's time with the Boston Red Sox finally reached its end?
I think you hit the nail on the head exactly, Jake. I think it's either Buchholz or Tommy Lane. I think those are going to be, the next cut is one of those two players. I would probably cut Tommy Lane first, but I'm not going to get very worked up if they cut Buchholz. And I know it's scary because it's easy to imagine, the Cardinals or the Pirates or maybe even the Cubs picking up Buchholz and turning him into a decent starter again. But, what faith do you have that that's going to happen in Boston right now? For me, it's pretty low. And even 2 months ago, I was still banging the drum that Buchholz can come back from this. He was so good in the first half of last year. You can't write somebody off just because of a few bad starts, but he's truly been an untenable, unrosterable solution this entire season. And like we talked about a little earlier in terms of like the virtues of the Pomeranz trade, this team wants to win now. They want to win this year. They want to try to win the next year or two, and it's not crazy to jettison a pitcher who's in his 30s who's wildly inconsistent over that. So, gun to my head, I'd probably let go of Tommy Lane first, but I will not be complaining if Buchholz is the next arm to go.
I want to talk about Buchholz's value a little bit here, because I think that Buchholz would generate some interest if he was made available on the trade market. As funny as that sounds from a guy who's just been completely inept the whole season, I think that Buchholz's track record of success would be appealing to a lot of clubs, and I think especially some of the National League clubs. In Alex Speer's newsletter that he puts out, 108 Stitches, he pointed out that Red Sox starters, when leaving the American League and going to the National League, have enjoyed really massive jumps in ERA, or lowering of ERA, I should say, when they've made that transition. So I wonder, you know, would Clay Buchholz be an interesting piece to dangle to a team like Milwaukee for one of those relievers, or is at least part of that deal to get something done? Do you think he has that type of value still?
No, I don't. You know, the thing about Buchholz is that rebuilding teams don't want him because he's old, and teams that are contending right now don't want him because he can't be relied upon. So I really don't see any sort of trade value for Buchholz at all. Maybe a player to be named later, but I think it's very wishful thinking if you're holding out and getting a return for Buchholz. Especially because other teams, other teams can see the Red Sox roster. They can see the pitchers they've acquired. They know Buchholz is pretty likely to be DFA'd. So I would be shocked if they got anything of consequence back for him at this point. Yeah, which might be an argument in favor of keeping him.
Right. You know, he may have a little bit more value if he is on your roster, because maybe they can figure him out. They've done it before, so maybe not that outlandish, but I'm saddened to think that we can't trick somebody into taking him from us for at least something, but who knows. The Red Sox have made a pretty big deal on the prospect front, though, and I alluded to it a little bit earlier in the show. Basically the same day, I believe, as the Espinosa trade, the Red Sox announced the signing of Jason Grom, who slots right into that number four prospect spot for me, right behind the big three there, and really softens the blow for Espinosa leaving. The other thing that I thought about when he signed is that this is really the first super talented minor league guy that has been signed under Dombrowski and will be wholly developed under the Bannister leadership, which I thought was kind of interesting too. So I wanted to get your take on that signing, what that means for the system, and whether you think that this is really the start of a new sort of wave of pitchers for the Red Sox.
Well, I think that absolutely, I don't think it's a coincidence that Espinosa was traded the same day that Grom was signed. I think the fact that knowing that they got a I don't think he's quite as good as Espinosa, but a prospect at least in that same caliber was added to the system is what allowed them to make that trade. The second part of the question is a lot harder to answer because, you know, as we alluded to this before, and I talked about it a lot in my articles this week and on Effectively Wild, the Red Sox have a systematic failure in terms of developing starting pitching. So I don't know if Dombrowski has fixed that already. I don't have enough knowledge to know who he has replaced in terms of minor league pitching coaches and guys who are advising pitchers as they come up through the ranks. So I don't know. I'm not as worried about the raw talent because the Red Sox have acquired pitchers with raw talent, right? Trey Ball was the number 7 overall pick. Matt Barnes was a first-rounder. Anthony Rinaldo was a supplemental first-rounder.
Right.
If you want to go back further than that, Michael Bowden was a first-rounder. Alan Webster was a highly regarded prospect when they acquired him. It's not that they haven't had the raw material. It's the inability to develop. So hopefully, in bringing along Grom with Michael Kopech still in the low minors, Dombrowski has identified this organizational weakness and is taking steps to remedy it. If the inability to develop moves along, unless Grom truly is someone like the next Lester, the next front of the rotation guy, I'm not sure how optimistic we can be that he will ever sort of live up to his upside either.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Until the Red Sox are able to actually make the change and start bringing a few of these guys along successfully, we're not going to believe that it can happen until it actually does. So that's pretty fair. I think we should probably mention, though, when talking about Michael Kopech, how ridiculous it is that he threw a pitch 105 miles an hour that was verified on multiple radar guns at the stadium. I mean, that's crazy. The hardest pitch ever recorded is 105.1 by Aroldis Chapman, and for all we know, he could have reached that.
I'm still betting on the guns being hot, but even if they're hot, it means he threw, 103? So it's wildly impressive.
Yeah, it's just stupid that somebody can throw a ball that hard. really interesting. In really minor league news, Sean Coyle was claimed off waivers by the Angels today. No real loss for the Red Sox system there. I did get to see Sean Coyle in person up in Portland a few weeks ago, and I think I turned to my wife during the game and said, this guy used to be something, and he just made a completely garbage throw from third base over to first. So that guy's really fallen apart completely. I remember when we actually thought he might be something.
Yeah, and for the Angels, it's certainly a worthy grab, right? Like, they have far and away the worst farm system in baseball. Coyle is an upper minors guy. You hope he turns it around. He has the bat speed. He has a ton of pop for a little guy. But the approach and the injuries are really what did him in. In addition to the fact that, like, as you alluded to, he's either a second baseman, you know, favorably, or maybe even a DH. He really can't play anywhere else. So you wish him all the best. But it says a good thing about your farm system when you can release a guy like Sean Coyle, who wouldn't have been in your top 20 or 30 prospects, and the Angels are probably snapping him up as a new top 10 guy.
Probably even top 5. That system's miserable.
It's pretty bad.
One of the things that really struck me about Coyle, though, was that arm, man. That thing is not meant for the hot corner. So, really interesting there that guy got picked up, but maybe he'll do something. Moncada and Benintendi, had to touch on those guys. They continue to thrive down in Portland. But one of the interesting things that was recently said by Mike Hazen was that they have no immediate plans to move Moncada's position. I think when we talked about this last time, I thought that maybe August would be a good time for them to start planning for the future. And this is sort of the time when guys reach the high minors and start having success that you plan, you know, not only for position, but for team need positionally. So I guess with the success that he's having, I'm a little surprised that they haven't started transitioning him over to third base, especially with Coyle, who was playing there before, now jettisoned from the team.
Yeah, I think and hope it's imminent. I think, like you said, you know, late this season, August, September, makes really only August for minor leaguers, makes perfect sense as to when they should try to start transitioning him. You know, the thing you have to remember about Moncada is this is still a player who's gone through a tremendous amount of change in the last 2 years. You know, new country, new league. He wasn't exclusively a second baseman. He was in Cuba. He's sort of already had to, like, you know, fully commit to second base. So I get it. I don't think there is any scenario in which Moncada contributes to the MLB roster this season, so they're not that worried about it yet. Wouldn't it all be surprised to see him start getting a few balls at third base very, very late this season, or open up next season starting to get them at third base? Because that truly would be his best fit, unless you want to start talking about him at right field or in left field. But I would certainly give him a shot at third base first. He certainly has the arm strength for it. However, his hands and his reactions at second base have received more mixed reviews. So it's not a foregone conclusion that he'll be a solid defensive third baseman. But I agree with you in that it's definitely something the Red Sox need to try, and I imagine they'll try it sooner than later.
Yeah, my feeling with Moncada at second base has been that I just don't think he has to expel all that much effort to play the position. So I think that if he was to put a lot of effort in defensively at third base, I could easily see him having the ability to be a plus defender at third base. And he certainly has the physicality to get the ball over. He's no Sean Coyle.
No, arm strength is never going to be the problem. It's going to be footwork. It's going to be reaction time. It's going to be glove work. I mean, the man is a freakish, freakish natural athlete. So raw tools are never going to be the issue. But third base is sort of an underratedly hard position to play, so we'll have to see how that goes out.
Yep, and my favorite position in baseball, so
here we go. Agreed. Very much, Sam.
Upcoming schedule for the Red Sox, another two-game teaser with the Giants this time. That happens at Fenway. I wish these series with the Giants would be longer because the last one was pretty amazing. We get Porcello versus Peavy and Pomerantz versus Kane. First look at Pomerantz there, so that'll be really interesting, and everybody in Red Sox Nation should probably turn in for that one. And then we get the lowly Twins at Fenway Park, which you know, with Wright versus Duffy, Erod versus Gibson, Price versus Nolasco, and Porcello versus Malone, in all rights with that offense behind them, probably should be a sweep, but, you know, you can never bank on something like that.
Yeah, it's baseball, so it probably won't be a sweep, but it's completely reasonable to look at the schedule and think the Red Sox should go 4-2. Right, they take 1 out of 2 from the Giants and 3 out of 4 from the Twins.
Yeah.
That sounds about right. Porcello versus Peavy, at this point in Peavy's career, Porcello should be favored. Pomeranz versus Kane, I mean, it's Pomeranz's first start in the AL, but it's against an NL team.
Right.
Matt Kane's pretty goddamn bad, so...
Yeah, he's a corpse out there. It's just amazing. I've never seen a guy turn as quickly after getting a contract as Matt Kane.
And it's so disappointing, because he was so much fun.
Yeah, I remember very distinctly that perfect game in 2012 or 13 it was, when he was just completely in control of the baseball game.
He was a ton of fun when he was in his prime.
Yeah.
And then against the Twins, you know, the only matchup that I think is even is Erod versus Gibson. But obviously our lineup's a lot better than the Twins. So the nature of baseball indicates we will not complete a 4-game sweep, because that's really hard to do even against terrible teams. But they should absolutely leave Minnesota with 3 out of 4.
Well, we'll probably see David Price work a lot of 3-0 counts against really bad Twins hitters, because that's what he does to irritate me specifically. So I think he's doing that because he wants to make me angry.
If that's his plan, he's doing a great job.
Yeah, he certainly is. Well, with that, Ben, I think we've covered off on a lot and certainly given our takes on this Pomeranz deal. For everybody out there, thanks for listening to the show. If you want to rate and review us, you can do so on iTunes. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes and on Stitcher. And you can follow me on Twitter at DevJake and Ben on Twitter at BenCarsley. So with that, Ben, thanks so much for joining us. And we'll be with you guys next week for episode 17.